We have just talked about ordination in general, and now we're going to take up the question of women and ordination. And you are sure, I'm sure you are aware of the resistance to the ordination of women, and sometimes when you confront that resistance, you have to answer the question, why ordain women? I'd like to start from the point, why not? Half the human race maybe is also a good candidate for ordination. But that's not the way it works. So, resistance to women in leadership. We've already looked at the household codes, the ideas of household management, and there I said that we have all of these elucidations of the ideal household that's male-run and male-controlled. At the same time, we know that it wasn't always like that, that there were households run by women, not only in Christianity, but in the society at large. And we don't get very many references to them because it's not the norm. And so the male writers don't want to talk about that. But in fact, it was going on. So the same with the whole question of leadership. We talked about women patrons. That was certainly an exercise of leadership. It was based on their social status and their wealth, as leadership often can be. And so women, as well as men, were exercising leadership in the form of patronage. There is resistance to this leadership of women all along. If we go back to Aristotle for a moment and his discussion in the Politics, he sees that the free-born Greek man is born to rule. It's just part of his DNA, you know, he's going to rule. And it has to be a Greek for him. Nobody else who isn't Greek. And if he were alive in the time when the Romans were in control, he would have said, no Romans either. And when Paul says Jew and Greek, he's including the Romans in the Greek. So what Greek means is a whole thing that changes with time, too. But this idea that some people simply are born to leadership and others just aren't going to have it, is deeply ingrained in this society. And some of it is gender-based. Some of it is based on status in birth, the family you're born into. But this kind of inequality, what we would call social inequality, is deeply ingrained. And I said before, I don't think any author in this society could say that men and women were fully equal. They just don't have a sense of that kind of the social thinking that came later. Okay, but equal with all one in access to salvation in Christ. Yes, very definitely. But then when it's played out in society, not so much. So they lived with those kinds of ambiguities, just as we live with a lot of social ambiguities today. And maybe they're a little different, but we still have plenty of social ambiguities. So resistance to women in leadership is based on all of that. And it's based on the whole idea of male honor being courage and leadership. Female honor being shyness, silence, keeping silent, and sexual propriety, very much. So, if you have an idea of women who should keep silent in society and men who should speak, that's a very gendered difference of ideal behavior. These women patrons, did they speak out when they needed to? Of course they did. So we're talking again about ideals and reality. So the idea that that the leadership of women should be resisted in the Christian community is nothing new. This is not unusual at all. It is reflecting the norms of society that they knew. And in Paul, you're probably familiar with some of these passages. In 1 Corinthians 11, for instance, in which you have this prolonged argument about how women should be veiled, how they should have their heads covered, the self-respecting woman wore some kind of a veil, head covering, in public. You already saw the images of those two patrons, Pontia Magna and Eumachia. They have their stola, which covers their head. They have covered heads. That's the way the respectable woman appeared in public, in the traditional mode. Now, what's very interesting is that we have a lot of examples of busts of women, Roman women, elite women, who don't have veils on their head. And I think one of the things that was changing exactly at the time of Paul was that. It seems as if the more Romanized women, and remember that that Paul's a Roman citizen, but he lives in the Eastern Mediterranean, and that the style was changing. It was becoming more acceptable for women not to wear veils. And he's talking about women who pray and prophesy in the Corinthian community, in 1 Corinthians 11. Very interesting. Pray and prophesy. He's not talking about silent prayer. Everybody probably did silent prayer. He's talking about public prayer. Women who aren't supposed to speak in church, they're speaking in church. And so, again, we have these anomalies of implications. So praying and prophesying, you do that publicly. You do that out loud. You do it speaking. So all he's concerned about there, he's not saying they shouldn't do that. He's saying they should wear veils when they do it. And so we have women in Paul's churches, and particularly in Corinth, who are speaking publicly in the church. But then in chapter 14, 34 to 35, you have this thing that seems to contradict that women should not speak in the church. They should be quiet. They should ask questions at home. And one interpretation of that, of course, is that these are ill-informed women who are going to ask stupid questions. Well, but why would only the women ask stupid questions? You know, it's a hard passage to interpret. There's some manuscript evidence that it wasn't there in the original, that it was added later, and that could well be, because it really does seem to contradict what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 11. And then, of course, in 1 Timothy 2, you have the prohibition of women teaching or having authority over men. And again, women patrons had social authority over men who were their clients. So, again, this is a kind of a conservative ideal that doesn't always match what was really going on. So there certainly is plenty of resistance that is mirrored, is reflected in Paul's letters, and it goes on later on in the church. And someone who is often pointed out is Tertullian. Poor Tertullian. He was married, first of all. He had a wife, and he comes out with some of these really awful things about women. And the my favorite one is that he says women are the devil's gateway because of Eve, who seduced Adam, and that's also in the 1 Timothy passage. You know, a note on this, very interesting. In all of Jewish biblical passages and exegesis, this idea of blaming Eve is very late. The first reference to it is in Sirach, which is 2nd century BC. Before that, there is no suggestion of that. And Paul in Romans 5, when he's writing about the effects of sin, he blames Adam. It's Adam who transgressed, you know. So the idea of blaming Eve is relatively late in the literature. And as I said, Tertullian was married, and I always imagine his wife sitting in the congregation while he's saying this and saying, oh, just wait till I get him home, you know. So Tertullian, is one of our, he's a poster child for this resistance to the leadership of women. And there's another piece that that enters in here, and that is about Montanism. Montanism was a charismatic charismatic movement. I meant to say movement and revival, and it came out removement. It was a charismatic movement or a charismatic revival that happened in Asia Minor, in present Turkey, in the second century, middle of the second century, and it was quite widespread. It was not heretical. It was a charismatic movement within the mainstream church that put priority on prophecy, had an emphasis on prophecy, on contemporary prophets, that prophecy was not something just in the Old Testament, it wasn't something just in the New Testament, which by now they have some sense of apostolic writings, but prophecy continues in our day. The male leader in this group was Montanus, and he gives his name to the movement, but it is well known that really there was a trio of leaders, and the other two were women. Their names were Priscilla and Maximilla. And some of the people who opposed this group were contemptuous of it precisely because they had women in leadership. These were women prophets, and the whole movement was known for that, for its acceptance of women in leadership. Tertullian, at some point in his life, became a Montanist in his later years. He embraced this movement. And then one wonders if he would have said the same kinds of things that he said earlier about women being the devil's gateway, etc. That was before his Montanist days. Because once he became enthusiastic about this movement and the belief in its prophecy, it was also apocalyptic. The end of the world was going to come, and it was going to come within our lifetime, and it was going to begin in a specific place, a little village called Tapuza in Asia Minor. And Tertullian embraced this group, this belief, and he would have had to backtrack, I think, on a lot of the things that he had said. So one of the ways in which mainstream non-Montanist Christian leaders, writers, could inveigh against women in leadership was by saying, women are in leadership in this group, look what they've done. They are not reputable. We don't accept them and see this is what happens when you put women in leadership. So that actually was done. That was argued. And so you had another situation there in which the Montanists, which were a very widespread group at one point, they certainly had spread to Rome and to North Africa, to Carthage, where Tertullian was. They probably were also in Gaul in France. So they were a widespread group there for a couple of generations, and then they kind of died out because, of course, the end didn't come the way it had been predicted. But they also furnished a handy foil for church leaders, male church leaders who opposed ordaining women and having women in leadership. Excuse me. They could use the example of the Montanists. So we have here no surprise, that it is a male-centered society, and that the common assumption was that men were better leaders, that that women just couldn't do it, except for the exceptions of prophecy and martyrdom, which we've already seen. But for the ordering of things, the perception was that, that men were the ones who were supposed to do that. And in many cultures, that's, of course, still true. And let me just say something about order and charism, because in many church by many church historians, and they're talking about the balance of this. Ordo is order. It's an ordination is part of that. It's the designation of leadership. It's the organization of leadership to keep things going smoothly and well run. Charism is the spiritual gift, the gift of the Holy Spirit. It's the spirit of prophecy, and it's the spirit of knocking things off balance a little, because one of the functions of prophecy is to challenge that order. It's to challenge the way things are done. Prophecy opens up new possibilities. It makes people look at what could be. And there's true prophecy and there's false prophecy, and so it requires discernment to see if what this prophetic thing is suggesting, if that's a good way to go. So women very definitely associated with prophecy. With the question of order, you've got this resistance for all the reasons we've talked about, all of the traditional reasons that we've talked about. And so in the church, it's the balance of the two that keeps the church authentic, faithful to Jesus, who himself was recognized as a prophet, you know. So it's the balance of the two that brings it all together. And women are very much part of that, and often leading the way in terms of prophecy, leading the way as ordained women, but with this difficulty that comes out of the culture and with which we still struggle.